Buch says that many animals are known to eat psilocybin mushrooms, including horses, cattle, and dogs. Some, like cows, appear unaffected, but many animals appear to enjoy an occasional change in consciousness, too. Buch is in charge of gathering mushroom poisoning reports for the North American Mycological Association, and over the years has seen accounts of horses tripping in their paddocks and dogs that, quote, zero in on psilocybes and appear to be hallucinating. Several primate species, aside from our own, are also known to enjoy psychedelic mushrooms. Presumably, animals with a taste for altered states of consciousness have helped spread psilocybin far and wide. Quote, the strains of a species that produced more rather than less psilocybin and psilocin would tend to be favored and so gradually become more widespread. Eaten in small doses, psychedelic mushrooms might well increase fitness in animals by increasing sensory acuity and possibly focus as well. A 2015 review article in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology reported that several tribes around the world feed psychoactive plants to their dogs in order to improve their hunting ability. The authors concluded that, quote, hallucinogenic plants alter perception in hunting dogs by diminishing extraneous signals and by enhancing sensory perception, most likely olfaction, that is directly involved in the detection and capture of game. At higher doses, however, one would think that animals tripping on psychedelic mushrooms would be at a distinct disadvantage for survival, and no doubt many of them are. But for a select few, the effects may offer some adaptive value, not only for themselves, but also possibly for the group and even the species. Here, we venture out onto highly speculative, slightly squishy ground, guided by an Italian ethnobotanist named Giorgio Samarini. In a book called Animals and Psychedelics, The Natural World and the Instinct to Alter Consciousness, Samarini hypothesizes that during times of rapid environmental change or crisis, it may avail the survival of a group when a few of its members abandon their accustomed conditioned responses and experiment with some radically new and different behaviors. Much like genetic mutations, most of these novelties will prove disastrous and be discarded by natural selection. But the laws of probability suggest that a few of the novel behaviors might end up being useful, helping the individual, the group, and possibly the species to adapt to rapid changes in their environment. Samarini calls this a depatterning factor. There are times in the evolution of a species where the old patterns no longer avail, and the radical, potentially innovative perceptions and behaviors that psychedelics sometimes inspire may offer the best chance for adaptation. Think of it as a neurochemically induced source of variation in a population. It is difficult to read about Samarini's lovely theory without thinking about our own species and the challenging circumstances in which we find ourselves today. Homo sapiens might have arrived at one of those periods of crisis that calls for some mental and behavioral depatterning. Could that be why nature has sent us these psychedelic molecules now? Such a notion would not strike Paul Stamets as the least bit far-fetched. As we stood around the fire pit, the warm light flickering across our faces, while our dinner sizzled in its pan, Stamets talked about what mushrooms have taught him about nature. He was expansive, eloquent, grandiose, and at times in acute danger of slipping the surly bonds of plausibility. We had had a few beers, and while we hadn't touched our tiny stash of Azzies, we had smoked a little pot. Stamets dilated on the idea of psilocybin as a chemical messenger sent from Earth, and how we had been elected, by virtue of the gift of consciousness and language, to hear its call and act before it's too late. Plants and mushrooms have intelligence, he said, and they want us to take care of the environment, and so they communicate that to us in a way we can understand. Why us? We humans are the most populous bipedal organisms walking around, so some plants and fungi are especially interested in enlisting our support. I think they have a consciousness and are constantly trying to direct our evolution by speaking out to us biochemically. We just need to be better listeners. These were riffs I'd heard Stamets deliver in countless talks and interviews. Quote, mushrooms have taught me the interconnectedness of all life forms and the molecular matrix that we share, he explains in another one. I no longer feel that I am in the envelope of a human life called Paul Stamets. I am part of the stream of molecules that are flowing through nature. I am given a voice, given consciousness for a time, but I feel that I am part of this continuum of stardust into which I am born and to which I will return at the end of this life. Stamets sounded very much like the volunteers I met at Hopkins who had had full-blown mystical experiences, people whose sense of themselves as individuals had been subsumed into a larger whole, a form of unitive consciousness which, in Stamets's case, had folded him into the web of nature as its not-so-humble servant. I think psilocybes have given me new insights that may allow me to help steer and speed fungal evolution so that we can find solutions to our problems, he said. Especially in times of ecological crisis, he suggests, we can't afford to wait for evolution, unfolding at its normal pace, to put forth these solutions in time. So let the depatterning begin. As Stamets held forth and forth, I couldn't help but picture in my mind Alex Gray's whacked painting of the stoned ape with the tornadoes of thought flying out of his hairy head. So much of what Stamets has to say treads a perilously narrow ledge, perched between the autodidact's soaring speculative flights and the stoned crank's late-night riffings that eventually send everyone in earshot off to bed. But just when I was beginning to grow impatient with his meanders and could hear the call of my sleeping bag from inside the yurt, he or I turned a corner, and his mycological prophecies suddenly appeared to me in a more generous light. The day before, Stamets had given me a tour of the labs and grow rooms at Fungi Perfecti, the company he founded right out of college. Tucked into the evergreen forest a short walk from his house, the Fungi Perfecti complex consists of a series of long white metal buildings that look like Quonset huts or small hangars. Outside are piles of wood chips, discarded fungi, and growing media. Some of the buildings house the grow rooms where he raises medicinal and edible species. Others contain his research facility with clean rooms and laminar flow chambers in which Stamets reproduces fungi from tissue culture and conducts his experiments. On the office walls hang several of his patents, framed. Amid the torrent of words, what I observed in these buildings was a salutary reminder that, while Stamets is surely a big talker, he is not just a talker. He is a big doer, too. A successful researcher and entrepreneur who is using fungi to make original contributions across a remarkably wide range of fields, from medicine and environmental restoration to agriculture and forestry and even national defense. Stamets is, in fact, a scientist, albeit of a special kind. Exactly what kind of scientist I didn't completely understand until a few weeks later, when I happened to read a wonderful biography of Alexander von Humboldt, the great early 19th century German scientist and colleague of Goethe's, who revolutionized our understanding of the natural world. Humboldt believed it is only with our feelings, our senses, and our imaginations, that is, with the faculties of human subjectivity, that we can ever penetrate nature's secrets. Nature everywhere speaks to man in a voice that is familiar to his soul, he writes. There is an order and beauty organizing the system of nature, a system that Humboldt, after briefly considering the name Gaia, chose to call cosmos, but it would never have revealed itself to us if not for the human imagination, which is itself, of course, a product of nature, of the very system it allows us to comprehend. The modern conceit of the scientist attempting to observe nature with perfect objectivity, as if from a vantage located outside it, would have been anathema to Humboldt. I myself, he said, am identical with nature. If Stamets is a scientist, as I believe he is, it is in the Humboldtian mold, making him something of a throwback. I don't mean to suggest his contribution is on the same order as Humboldt's, but he too is an amateur in the best sense, self-taught, uncredentialed, and blithe about trespassing disciplinary borders. He, too, is an accomplished naturalist and inventor with several new species and patents to his credit. He, too, hears nature's voice, and it is his imagination, wild as it often is, that allows him to see systems where others have not, such as what is going on beneath our feet in a forest. I'm thinking, for example, of the Earth's Internet, the neurological network of nature, and the forest's immune system, three romantic-sounding metaphors that it would be foolish to bet against. What strikes me about both Stamets and many of the so-called romantic scientists, like Humboldt and Goethe, Joseph Banks, Erasmus Darwin, and I would include Thoreau, is how very much more alive nature seems in their hands than it would soon become in the cooler hands of the professionals. These more specialized scientists, a word that wasn't coined until 1834, gradually moved science indoors and increasingly gazed at nature through devices that allowed them to observe it at scales invisible to the human eye. These moves subtly changed the object of study, indeed made it more of an object. Instead of seeing nature as a collection of discrete objects, the romantic scientists, and I include Stamets in their number, saw a densely tangled web of subjects, each acting on the other in the great dance that would come to be called coevolution. Everything, Humboldt said, is interaction and reciprocal. They could see this dance of subjectivities because they cultivated the plant's eye view, the animal's eye view, the microbe's eye view, and the fungus's eye view, perspectives that depend as much on imagination as observation. I suspect that that imaginative leap has become harder for us moderns to make. Our science and technology encourage us in precisely the opposite direction, toward the objectification of nature and of all species other than our own. Surely we need to acknowledge the practical power of this perspective, which has given us so much, but we should at the same time acknowledge its costs, material as well as spiritual. Yet that older, more enchanted way of seeing may still pay dividends, as it does, to cite just one small example, when it allows Paul Stamets to figure out that the reason honeybees like to visit woodpiles is to medicate themselves by nibbling on a saprophytic mycelium that produces just the right antimicrobial compound that the hive needs to survive, a gift the fungus is trading for what? Something yet to be imagined. Coda. You're probably wondering whatever happened to the Aziz Stamets and I found that weekend. Many months later, in the middle of a summer week spent in the house in New England where we used to live, a place freighted with memories, I ate them with Judith. I crumbled two little mushrooms in each of two glasses and poured hot water over them to make a tea. Stamets had recommended that I cook the mushrooms to destroy the compounds that can upset the stomach. Judith and I each drank half a cup, ingesting both the liquid and the crumbles of mushroom. I suggested we take a walk on the dirt road near our house while we waited for the psilocybin to come on. However, after only about 20 minutes or so, Judith reported she was feeling things, none of them pleasant. She didn't want to be walking anymore, she said, but now we were at least a mile from home. She told me her mind and her body seemed to be drifting apart, and that her mind had flown out of her head and up into the trees like a bird or insect. I need to get home and feel safe, she said, now with some urgency. I tried to reassure her as we abruptly turned around and picked up our pace. It was hot, and the air was thick with humidity. She said, I really don't want to run into anybody. I assured her we wouldn't. I still felt more or less myself, but it may be that Judith's distress was keeping me from feeling the mushrooms. Somebody had to be ready to act normally if a neighbor happened to drive by and roll down his window for a chat, a prospect that was quickly taking on the proportions of nightmare. In fact, shortly before we got back to home base, so it now felt to both of us, we spotted a neighbor's pickup truck bearing down on us, and, like guilty children, we ducked into the woods until it passed. Judith made a beeline for the couch in the living room, where she lay down with the shades drawn, while I went into the kitchen to polish off my cup of mushroom tea, because I wasn't yet feeling very much. I was a little worried about her, but once she reached her base on the living room couch, her mood lightened and she said she was fine. I couldn't understand her desire to be indoors. I went out and sat on the screen porch for a while, listening to the sounds in the garden, which suddenly grew very loud, as if the volume had been turned way up. The air was stock still, but the desultory sounds of flying insects and the digital buzz of hummingbirds rose to form a cacophony that I had never heard before. It began to grate on my nerves until I decided I would be better off regarding the sound as beautiful. And then, all at once, it was. I lifted an arm, then a foot, and noted with relief that I wasn't paralyzed, though I also didn't feel like moving a muscle. Whenever I closed my eyes, random images erupted as if the insides of my lids were a screen. My notes record fractal patterns, tunnels plunging through foliage, ropey vines forming grids. But when I started to feel panic rise at the lack of control I had over my visual field, I discovered that all I needed to do to restore a sense of semi-normalcy was to open my eyes. To open or close my eyes was like changing the channel. I thought, I am learning how to manage this experience. Much happened or seemed to happen during the course of that August afternoon, but I want to focus here on just one element of the experience because it bears on the questions of nature and our place in it that psilocybin seems to provoke, at least for me. I decided I wanted to walk out to my writing house, a little structure I had built myself 25 years ago in what is now another life, which holds a great many memories. I had written 2.5 books in the little room, including one about building it, sitting before a broad window that looked back over a pond and the garden to our house. However, I was still vaguely worried about Judith, so before wandering too far from the house, I went inside to check on her. She was stretched out on the couch with a cool, damp cloth over her eyes. She was fine. "I'm having these very interesting visuals," she said, something having to do with the stains on the coffee table coming to life, swirling and transforming and rising from the surface in ways she found compelling. She made it clear she wanted to be left alone to sink more deeply into the images. She is a painter. The phrase parallel play popped into my mind, and so it would be for the rest of the afternoon. I stepped outside, feeling unsteady on my feet, legs a little rubbery. The garden was thrumming with activity, dragonflies tracing complicated patterns in the air, the seed heads of plume poppies rattling like snakes as I brushed by, the phlox perfuming the air with its sweet, heavy scent, and the air itself so palpably dense it had to be forded. The word and the sense of poignance flooded over me during the walk through the garden, and it would return later. Maybe because we no longer live here, and this garden, where we spent so many summers as a couple and then a family, and which at this moment seemed so acutely present, was in fact now part of an irretrievable past. It was as if a precious memory had not just been recalled, but had actually come back to life in a reincarnation both beautiful and cruel. Also heartrending was the fleetingness of this moment in time, the ripeness of a New England garden in late August on the verge of turning the corner of the season. Before dawn one cloudless night, very soon and without warning, the thrum and bloom and perfume would end all at once with the arrival of the killing frost. I felt wide open emotionally, undefended. When at last I arrived at the writing house, I stretched out on the daybed, something I hardly ever took the time to do in all the years when I was working here so industriously. The bookshelves had been emptied and the place felt abandoned, a little sad. From where I lay, I could see over my toes to the window screen and past that to the grid of an arbor that was now densely woven with the twining vines of what had become a venerable old climbing hydrangea, a petiolaris. I had planted the hydrangea decades ago in hopes of creating just this sort of intricately tangled prospect. Backlit by the late afternoon sunlight streaming in, its neat round leaves completely filled the window, which meant you gazed out at the world through the fresh green scrim they formed. It seemed to me these were the most beautiful leaves I had ever seen. It was as if they were emitting their own soft green glow. And it felt like a kind of privilege to gaze out at the world through their eyes, as it were, as the leaves drank up the last drafts of sunlight, transforming those photons into new matter. A plant's eye view of the world. It was that, and for real. But the leaves were also looking back at me, fixing me with this utterly benign gaze. I could feel their curiosity, and what I was certain was an attitude of utter benevolence toward me and my kind. Do I need to say that I know how crazy this sounds? I do. I felt as though I were communing directly with a plant for the first time, and that certain ideas I had long thought about and written about, having to do with the subjectivity of other species and the way they act upon us in ways we're too self-regarding to appreciate, had taken on the flesh of feeling and reality. I looked through the negative spaces formed by the hydrangea leaves to fix my gaze on the swamp maple in the middle of the meadow beyond, and it, too, was now more alive than I'd ever known a tree to be, infused with some kind of spirit, this one, too, benevolent. The idea that there had ever been a disagreement between matter and spirit seemed risible, and I felt as though whatever it is that usually divides me from the world out there had begun to fall away. Not completely. The battlements of ego had not fallen. This was not what the researchers would deem a complete mystical experience, because I retained the sense of an observing eye. But the doors and windows of perception had opened wide, and they were admitting more of the world and its myriad non-human personalities than ever before. Buoyed by this development, I sat up now and looked out over my desk through the big window that faced back to the house. When I sighted the building, I carefully framed the main view between two very old and venerable trees, a stolidly vertical ash on the right and an elegantly angled and intricately branched white oak on the left. The ash has seen better days. Storms have shorn several important limbs from it, wrecking its symmetry and leaving some ragged stumps. The oak was somewhat healthier, in full leaf now, with its upturned limbs reaching into the sky like the limbs of a dancer. But the main trunk, which had always leaned precariously to one side, now concerned me. A section of it had rotted out at ground level, and for the first time it was possible to look clear through it and see daylight. How is it possibly still standing? As I gazed at the two trees I had gazed at so many times before from my desk, it suddenly dawned on me that these trees were, obviously, my parents. The stolid ash, my father, the elegant oak, my mother. I don't know exactly what I mean by that, except that thinking about those trees became identical to thinking about my parents. They were completely, indelibly present in those trees. And so I thought about all that they had given me, and about all that time had done to them, and what was going to become of this prospect, this place, this me, when they finally fell, as eventually they would. That parents die is not exactly the stuff of epiphany, but the prospect, no longer distant or abstract, pierced me more deeply than it ever had, and I was disarmed yet again by the pervasive sense of poignancy that trailed me all that afternoon. Yet I must still have had some wits about me, because I made a note to call the arborist tomorrow. Maybe something could be done to reduce the weight on the leaning side of the oak in order to prevent it from falling, if only for a while longer. My walk back to the house was, I think, the peak of the experience, and comes back to me now in the colors and tones of a dream. There was, again, the sense of pushing my body through a mass of air that had been sweetened by flocks and was teeming, almost frenetic with activity. The dragonflies, big as birds, were now out in force, touching down just long enough to kiss the phlox blossoms and then lift off before madly crisscrossing the garden path. These were more dragonflies than I had ever seen in one place, so many, in fact, that I wasn't completely sure if they were real. Judith later confirmed the sighting when I got her to come outside. And as they executed their flight patterns, they left behind them contrails that persisted in the air, or so at least it appeared. Dusk now approaching, the air traffic in the garden had built to a riotous crescendo. The pollinators making their last rounds of the day, the plants still signifying to them with their flowers, me, me, me. In one way, I knew this scene well, the garden coming briefly back to life after the heat of a summer day has relented. But never had I felt so integral to it. I was no longer the alienated human observer, gazing at the garden from a distance, whether literal or figural, but rather felt part and parcel of all that was transpiring here. So the flowers were addressing me as much as the pollinators, and perhaps because the very air that afternoon was such a felt presence, one's usual sense of oneself as a subject observing objects in space, objects that have been thrown into relief and rendered discreet by the apparent void that surrounds them, gave way to a sense of being deep inside and fully implicated in the scene, one more being in relation to the myriad other beings and to the whole. Everything is interaction and reciprocal, wrote Humboldt, and that felt very much the case. And so, for the first time I can remember, did this. I myself am identical with nature. I honestly don't know what to make of this experience. In a certain light, at certain moments, I feel as though I had had some kind of spiritual experience. I had felt the personhood of other beings in a way I hadn't before. Whatever it is that keeps us from feeling our full implication in nature had been temporarily in abeyance. There had also been, I felt, an opening of the heart, toward my parents, yes, and toward Judith, but also, weirdly, toward some of the plants and trees and birds and even the damn bugs on our property. Some of this openness has persisted. I think back on it now as an experience of wonder and imminence. The fact that this transformation of my familiar world into something I can only describe as numinous was occasioned by the eating of a little brown mushroom that Stamets and I had found growing on the edge of a parking lot in a state park on the Pacific coast, well, that fact can be viewed in one of two ways. Either as an additional wonder, or as support for a more prosaic and materialist interpretation of what happened to me that August afternoon. According to one interpretation, I had had a drug experience, plain and simple. It was a kind of waking dream, interesting and pleasurable, but signifying nothing. The psilocin in that mushroom unlocked the 5-hydroxytryptamine 2A receptors in my brain, causing them to fire wildly and set off a cascade of disordered mental events that, among other things, permitted some thoughts and feelings, presumably from my subconscious, and perhaps from my reading too, to get cross-wired with my visual cortex as it was processing images of the trees and plants and insects in my field of vision. Not quite a hallucination. Projection is probably the psychological term for this phenomenon, when we mix our emotions with certain objects that then reflect those feelings back to us so that they appear to glisten with meaning. T.S. Eliot called these things and situations the objective correlatives of human emotion. Emerson had a similar phenomenon in mind when he said that nature always wears the colors of the spirit, suggesting it is our minds that dress her in such significance. I'm struck by the fact there was nothing supernatural about my heightened perceptions that afternoon, nothing that I needed an idea of magic or a divinity to explain. No, all it took was another perceptual slant on the same old reality, a lens or mode of consciousness that invented nothing but merely italicize the prose of ordinary experience, disclosing the wonder that is always there in the garden or wood, hidden in plain sight. Another form of consciousness parted from us, as William James put it, by the filmiest of screens. Nature does, in fact, teem with subjectivities other than our own. Call them spirits, if you like. It is only the human ego, with its imagined monopoly on subjectivity, that keeps us from recognizing them all, our kith and kin. In this sense, I guess Paul Stamets is right to think the mushrooms are bringing us messages from nature, or at least helping us to open up and read them. Before this afternoon, I had always assumed access to a spiritual dimension hinged on one's acceptance of the supernatural, of God, of a beyond, but now I'm not so sure. The beyond, whatever it consists of, might not be nearly as far away or inaccessible as we think. Houston Smith, the scholar of religion, once described a spiritually realized being as simply a person with, quote, an acute sense of the astonishing mystery of everything. Faith need not figure. Maybe to be in a garden and feel awe or wonder in the presence of an astonishing mystery is nothing more than a recovery of a misplaced perspective, perhaps the child's eye view. Maybe we regain it by means of a neurochemical change that disables the filters of convention, of ego, that prevent us in ordinary hours from seeing what is, like those lovely leaves, staring us in the face. I don't know. But if those dried up little scraps of fungus taught me anything, it is that there are other, stranger forms of consciousness available to us, and whatever they mean, their very existence, to quote William James again, forbids a premature closing of our accounts with reality. Open-minded and be-mushroomed, that was me now, ready to reopen my own accounts with reality. Chapter 3. History, the first wave. When the federal authorities came down hard on Timothy Leary in the mid-1960s, hitting him with a 30-year sentence for attempting to bring a small amount of marijuana over the border at Laredo, Texas in 1966, the embattled former psychology professor turned to Marshall McLuhan for some advice. The country was in the throes of a moral panic about LSD, inspired in no small part by Leary's own promotion of psychedelic drugs as a means of personal and cultural transformation, and by his recommendation to America's youth that they turn on, tune in, drop out. Dated and goofy as those words sound to our ears, there was a moment when they were treated as a credible threat to the social order, an invitation to America's children not only to take mind-altering drugs, but to reject the path laid out for them by their parents and their government, including the path taking young men to Vietnam. Also in 1966, Leary was called before a committee of the U.S. Senate to defend his notorious slogan, which he gamely, if not very persuasively, attempted to do. In the midst of the national storm raging around him, a storm, it should be said, he quite enjoyed, Leary met with Marshall McLuhan over lunch at the Plaza Hotel in New York, the LSD guru betting that the media guru might have some tips on how best to handle the public and the press. Dreary Senate hearing and courtrooms are not the platforms for your message, Tim, McLuhan advised, in a conversation that Leary recounts in Flashbacks, one of his many autobiographies. Leary would write another one every time legal fees and alimony payments threatened to empty his bank account. To dispel fear, you must use your public image. You are the basic product endorser. The product by this point, of course, was LSD. Whenever you are photographed, smile. Wave reassuringly, radiate courage, never complain or appear angry. It's okay if you come off as flamboyant and eccentric. You're a professor, after all. But a confident attitude is the best advertisement. You must be known for your smile. Leary took McLuhan's advice to heart. In virtually all of the many thousands of photographs taken of him from that lunch date forward, Leary made sure to present the gift of his most winning grin to the camera. It didn't matter if he was coming into or out of a courthouse, addressing a throng of youthful admirers in his love beads and white robes, being jostled into a squad car freshly handcuffed, or perched on the edge of John and Yoko's bed in a Montreal hotel room, Timothy Leary always managed to summon a bright smile and a cheerful wave for the camera. So, ever smiling, the charismatic figure of Timothy Leary looms large over the history of psychedelics in America. Yet it doesn't take many hours in the library before you begin to wonder if maybe Timothy Leary looms a little too large in that history, or at least in our popular understanding of it. I was hardly alone in assuming that the Harvard Psilocybin Project, launched by Leary in the fall of 1960, immediately after his first life-changing experience with psilocybin in Mexico, represented the beginning of serious academic research into these substances, or that Leary's dismissal from Harvard in 1963 marked the end of that research. But in fact, neither proposition is even remotely true. Leary played an important role in the modern history of psychedelics, but it's not at all the pioneering role he wrote for himself. His success in shaping the popular narrative of psychedelics in the 1960s obscures as much as it reveals, creating a kind of reality distortion field that makes it difficult to see everything that came either before or after his big moment on stage. In a truer telling of the history, the Harvard Psilocybin Project would appear more like the beginning of the end of what had been a remarkably fertile and promising period of research that unfolded during the previous decade far from Cambridge, in places as far-flung as Saskatchewan, Vancouver, California, and England, and everywhere with a lot less sound and fury or countercultural baggage. The larger-than-life figure of Leary has also obscured from view the role of a dedicated but little-known group of scientists, therapists, and passionate amateurs who, long before Leary had ever tried psilocybin or LSD, developed the theoretical framework to make sense of these unusual chemicals and devised the therapeutic protocols to put them to use healing people. Many of these researchers eventually watched in dismay as Leary and his antics, as they inevitably referred to his various stunts and pronouncements, ignited what would become a public bonfire of all their hard-won knowledge and experience. In telling the modern history of psychedelics, I want to put aside the Leary saga, at least until the crack-up where it properly belongs, to see if we can't recover some of that knowledge and the experience that produced it without passing it through the light-bending prism of the psychedelic 60s. In doing so, I'm following in the steps of several of the current generation of psychedelic researchers who, beginning in the late 1990s, set out to excavate the intellectual ruins of this first flowering of research into LSD and psilocybin and were astounded by what they found. Stephen Ross is one such researcher. A psychiatrist specializing in addiction at Bellevue, he directed an NYU trial using psilocybin to treat the existential distress of cancer patients, to which I will return later. Since then, he has turned to the treatment of alcoholics with psychedelics, what had been perhaps the single most promising area of clinical research in the 1950s. When, several years ago, an NYU colleague mentioned to Ross that LSD had once been used to treat thousands of alcoholics in Canada and the United States, and that Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, had sought to introduce LSD therapy into AA in the 1950s, Ross, who was in his 30s at the time, did some research and was flabbergasted by all that he, as an expert on the treatment of alcoholism, did not know and hadn't been told. His own field had a secret history. I felt a little like an archaeologist unearthing a completely buried body of knowledge. Beginning in the early 50s, psychedelics had been used to treat a whole host of conditions, including addiction, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, autism, and end-of-life anxiety. There had been 40,000 research participants and more than 1,000 clinical papers, Ross said. The American Psychiatric Association had whole meetings centered around LSD, this new wonder drug. In fact, there were 6 international scientific meetings devoted to psychedelics between 1950 and 1965. Some of the best minds in psychiatry had seriously studied these compounds and therapeutic models with government funding, he said. But after the culture and the psychiatric establishment turned against psychedelics in the mid-1960s, an entire body of knowledge was effectively erased from the field, as if all that research and clinical experience had never happened. Says Ross, by the time I got to medical school in the 1990s, no one even talked about it. When LSD burst onto the psychiatric scene in 1950, the drug's effect on patients and researchers who routinely tried the drug on themselves were so novel and strange that scientists struggled for the better part of a decade to figure out what these extraordinary experiences were or meant. How exactly did this new mind-altering drug fit into the existing paradigms for understanding the mind and the prevailing modes of psychiatry and psychotherapy? A lively debate over these questions went on for more than a decade. What wasn't known at the time is that beginning in 1953, the CIA was conducting its own classified research into psychedelics and was struggling with similar issues of interpretation and application. Was LSD best regarded as a potential truth serum, or a mind control agent, or a chemical weapon? The world's very first LSD trip, and the only one undertaken with no prior expectations, was the one that Albert Hofmann took in 1943. While it left him uncertain whether he had experienced madness or transcendence, Hofmann immediately sensed the potential importance of the compound for neurology and psychiatry. So Sandoz, the pharmaceutical company for which he worked at the time of his discovery, did something unusual. In effect, it crowdsourced a worldwide research effort to figure out what in the world Delicid, its brand name for LSD-25, might be good for. Hoping someone somewhere would hit upon a commercial application for its spookily powerful new compound, Sandoz offered to supply, free of charge, however much LSD any researcher requested. The company defined the term researcher liberally enough to include any therapist who promised to write up his or her clinical observations. This policy remained more or less unchanged from 1949 to 1966 and was in large part responsible for setting off the first wave of psychedelic research, the one that crashed in 1966 when Sandoz, alarmed at the controversy that had erupted around its experimental drug, abruptly withdrew Delicid from circulation. So what was learned during that fertile and freewheeling period of investigation? A straightforward question, and yet the answer is complicated by the very nature of these drugs, which is anything but straightforward. As the literary theorists would say, the psychedelic experience is highly constructed. If you are told you will have a spiritual experience, chances are pretty good that you will. And likewise, if you are told the drug may drive you temporarily insane, or acquaint you with the collective unconscious, or help you access cosmic consciousness, or revisit the trauma of your birth, you stand a good chance of having exactly that kind of experience. Psychologists call these self-fulfilling prophecies expectancy effects, and they turn out to be especially powerful in the case of psychedelics. So, for example, if you have ever read Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception, which was published in 1954, your own psychedelic experience has probably been influenced by the author's mysticism, and specifically the mysticism of the East to which Huxley was inclined. Indeed, even if you have never read Huxley, his construction of the experience has probably influenced your own, for that Eastern flavoring, think of the Beatles song, Tomorrow Never Knows, would come to characterize the LSD experience from 1954 on. Leary would pick up the psychedelic Orientalism from Huxley and then greatly amplify it when he and his Harvard colleagues wrote a best-selling manual for psychedelic experience based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Further complicating the story and adding another feedback loop, Huxley was inspired to try psychedelics and write about the experience by a scientist who gave him mescaline in the explicit hope that a great writer's descriptions and metaphors would help him and his colleagues make sense of an experience they were struggling to interpret. So did Aldous Huxley make sense of the modern psychedelic experience, or did he in some sense invent it? This hall of epistemological mirrors was just one of the many challenges facing the researchers who wanted to bring LSD into the field of psychiatry and psychotherapy. Psychedelic therapy could look more like shamanism or faith healing than medicine. Another challenge was the irrational exuberance that seemed to infect any researchers who got involved with LSD, an enthusiasm that might have improved the results of their experiments. At the same time, it fueled the skepticism of colleagues who remained psychedelic virgins. Yet a third challenge was how to fit psychedelics into the existing structures of science and psychiatry, if indeed that was possible. How do you do a controlled experiment with a psychedelic? How do you effectively blind your patients and clinicians or control for the powerful expectancy effect? When set and setting play such a big role in the patient's experience, how can you hope to isolate a single variable or design a therapeutic application? Part 1. The Promise. The drugs weren't called psychedelics at the beginning. That term wasn't introduced until 1957. In the same way that Sandoz couldn't figure out what it had on its hands with LSD, the researchers experimenting with the drug couldn't figure out what to call it. Over the course of the 1950s, this class of drugs underwent a succession of name changes as our understanding of the chemicals and their action evolved, each new name reflecting the shifting interpretation, or was it a construction, of what these strange and powerful molecules meant and did. The first name was perhaps the most awkward. Beginning around 1950, shortly after LSD was made available to researchers, the compound was known as a psychotomimetic, which is to say a mind drug that mimicked psychoses. This was the most obvious and parsimonious interpretation of a psychedelic's effects. Viewed from the outside, people given doses of LSD and later psilocybin exhibited many of the signs of a temporary psychosis. Early researchers reported a range of disturbing symptoms in their LSD volunteers, including depersonalization, loss of ego boundaries, distorted body image, synesthesia, seeing sounds or hearing sights, emotional lability, giggling and weeping, distortion of the sense of time, delirium, hallucinations, paranoid delusions, and in the words of one writer, a tantalizing sense of portentousness. When researchers administered standardized psychiatric tests to volunteers on LSD, such as the Rorschach ink blots or the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, the results mirrored those of psychotics, and specifically schizophrenics. Volunteers on LSD appeared to be losing their minds. This suggested to some researchers that LSD held promise as a tool for understanding psychosis, which is precisely how Sandoz initially marketed Delicit. Although the drug might not cure anything, the resemblance of its effects to the symptoms of schizophrenia suggested that the mental disorder might have a chemical basis that LSD could somehow illuminate. For clinicians, the drug promised to help them better understand and empathize with their schizophrenic patients. That, of course, meant taking the drugs themselves, which seems odd, even scandalous to us today. But in the years before 1962, when Congress passed a law giving the FDA authority to regulate new investigational drugs, this was in fact common practice. Indeed, it was considered the ethical thing to do, for to not take the drug yourself was tantamount to treating your patients as guinea pigs. Humphrey Osmond wrote that the extraordinary promise of LSD was to allow the therapist who took it to, quote, enter the illness and see with a madman's eyes, hear with his ears, and feel with his skin. Born in Surrey, England in 1917, Osmond is a little-known but pivotal figure in the history of psychedelic research, probably contributing more to our understanding of these compounds and their therapeutic potential than any other single researcher. Osmond's story and the rich Canadian history of psychedelic research is well told in Erica Dyke, Psychedelic Psychiatry, LSD from Clinic to Campus. In the years following World War II, Osmond, a tall reed of a man with raucous teeth, was practicing psychiatry at St. George's Hospital in London when a colleague named John Smithies introduced him to an obscure body of medical literature about mescaline. After learning that mescaline induced hallucinations much like those reported by schizophrenics, the two researchers began to explore the idea that the disease was caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. At a time when the role of brain chemistry in mental illness had not yet been established, this was a radical hypothesis. The two psychiatrists had observed that the molecular structure of mescaline closely resembled that of adrenaline. Could schizophrenia result from some kind of dysfunction in the metabolism of adrenaline, transforming it into a compound that produced the schizophrenic rupture with reality? No, as it would turn out, but it was a productive hypothesis even so, and Osmond's research into the biochemical basis of mental illness contributed to the rise of neurochemistry in the 1950s. LSD research would eventually give an important boost to the nascent field. The fact that such a vanishingly small number of LSD molecules could exert such a profound effect on the mind was an important clue that a system of neurotransmitters with dedicated receptors might play a role in organizing our mental experience. This insight eventually led to the discovery of serotonin and the class of antidepressants known as SSRIs. But the powers that be at St. George's Hospital were unsupportive of Osmond's research on mescaline. In frustration, the young doctor went looking for a more hospitable institution in which to conduct it. This he found in the Western Canadian province of Saskatchewan, of all places. Beginning in the mid-1940s, the province's leftist government had instituted several radical reforms in public policy, including the nation's first system of publicly funded health care. It became the model for the system Canada would adopt in 1966. Hoping to make the province a center of cutting-edge medical research, the government offered generous funding and a rare degree of freedom to lure researchers to the frozen wastes of the Canadian prairies. After replying to an ad in The Lancet, Osmond received an invitation from the provincial government to move his family and his novel research project to the remote agrarian community of Weyburn, Saskatchewan, 45 miles north of the North Dakota border. The Saskatchewan Mental Hospital in Weyburn would soon become the world's most important hub of research into psychedelics, or rather, into the class of compounds still known as psychotomimetics. That paradigm still ruled the thinking of Osmond and his new like-minded colleague and research director, a Canadian psychiatrist named Abram Hoffer, as they began conducting experiments using a supply of LSD-25 obtained from Sandoz. The psychotomimetic model was introduced to the general public in 1953 when Maclean's, the popular Canadian magazine, published a harrowing account of a journalist's experience on LSD titled My 12 Hours as a Madman. Sidney Katz had become the first civilian to participate in one of Osman and Hoffer's LSD experiments at Weyburn Hospital. Katz had been led to expect madness, and madness he duly experienced. I saw faces of familiar friends turn into fleshless skulls and the heads of menacing witches, pigs, and weasels. The gaily patterned carpet at my feet was transformed into a fabulous heaving mass of living matter, part vegetable, part animal. Katz's article, which was illustrated with an artist's rendering of chairs flying through a collapsing room, reads like the work of a fervent anti-LSD propagandist circa 1965. I was repeatedly held in the grip of a terrifying hallucination in which I could feel and see my body convulse and shrink until all that remained was a hard, sickly stone. Yet curiously, his 12 hours of insanity were not all filled with horror, he reported. At times, I beheld visions of dazzling beauty, visions so rapturous, so unearthly, that no artist will ever paint them. During this period, Osman and Hoffer administered Sandoz LSD to dozens of people, including colleagues, friends, family members, volunteers, and of course themselves. Their focus on LSD as a window into the biochemistry of mental illness gradually gave way to a deepening curiosity about the power of the experience itself and whether the perceptual disturbances produced by the drug might themselves confer some therapeutic benefit. During a late-night brainstorming session in an Ottawa hotel room in 1953, Osmond and Hoffer noted that the LSD experience appeared to share many features with the descriptions of delirium tremens reported by alcoholics, the hellish, days-long bout of madness alcoholics often suffer while in the throes of withdrawal. Many recovering alcoholics look back on the hallucinatory horrors of the DTs as a conversion experience and the basis of the spiritual awakening that allows them to remain sober. The idea that an LSD experience could mimic the DTs seemed so bizarre that we laughed uproariously, Hoffer recalled years later. But when our laughter subsided, the question seemed less comical, and we formed our hypothesis. Would a controlled LSD-produced delirium help alcoholics stay sober? Here was an arresting application of the psychotomimetic paradigm. Use a single high-dose LSD session to induce an episode of madness in an alcoholic that would simulate delirium tremens, shocking the patient into sobriety. Over the next decade, Osman and Hoffer tested this hypothesis on more than 700 alcoholics, and in roughly half the cases, they reported, the treatment worked. The volunteers got sober and remained so for at least several months. Not only was the new approach more effective than other therapies, but it suggested a whole new way to think about psychopharmacology. From the first, Hoffer wrote, we considered not the chemical, but the experience as a key factor in therapy. This novel idea would become a central tenet of psychedelic therapy. The emphasis on what subjects felt represented a major break with the prevailing ideas of behaviorism in psychology, in which only observable and measurable outcomes counted and subjective experience was deemed irrelevant. The analysis of these subjective experiences, sometimes called phenomenology, had of course been the basis of Freudian psychoanalysis, which behaviorism had rejected as insufficiently rigorous or scientific. There was no point in trying to get inside the mind. It was, in B.F. Skinner's famous phrase, a black box. Instead, you measured what you could measure, which was outward behavior. The work with psychedelics would eventually spark a revival of interest in the subjective dimensions of the mind, in consciousness. How ironic that it took, of all things, a chemical, LSD-25, to bring interiority back into psychology. And yet, successful as the new therapy seemed to be, there was a nagging little problem with the theoretical model on which it was based. When the therapists began to analyze the reports of volunteers, their subjective experiences while on LSD bore little, if any, resemblance to the horrors of the DTs or to madness of any kind. To the contrary, their experiences were, for the most part, incredibly and bafflingly positive. When Osmond and Hoffer began to catalog their volunteers' session reports, so-called psychotic changes, hallucinations, paranoia, anxiety, sometimes occurred, but there were also descriptions of, say, quote, a transcendental feeling of being united with the world, one of the most common feelings reported. Rather than madness, most volunteers described sensations such as a new ability to see oneself objectively, enhancement in the sensory fields, profound new understandings in the field of philosophy or religion, and increased sensitivity to the feelings of others. In spite of the powerful expectancy effect, symptoms that looked nothing like those of insanity were busting through the researchers' preconceptions. For many of the alcoholics treated at Weyburn Hospital, the core of the LSD experience seemed to involve something closer to transcendence or spiritual epiphany than temporary psychosis. Osmond and Hoffer began to entertain doubts about their delirium tremens model, and eventually to wonder if perhaps the whole psychotomimetic paradigm and name for these drugs might need retooling. They received a strong push in that direction from Aldous Huxley after his mescaline trip, which he declared bore scant resemblance to psychosis. What a psychiatrist might diagnose as depersonalization, hallucinations, or mania might better be thought of as instances of mystical union, visionary experience, or ecstasy. Could it be that the doctors were mistaking transcendence for insanity? At the same time, Osmond and Hoffer were learning from their volunteers that the environment in which the LSD session took place exerted a powerful effect on the kinds of experiences people had, and that one of the best ways to avoid a bad session was the presence of an engaged and empathetic therapist, ideally someone who had had his or her own LSD experience. They came to suspect that the few psychotic reactions they did observe might actually be an artifact of the metaphorical white room and white-coated clinician. Though the term set and setting would not be used in this context for several more years and became closely identified with Timothy Leary's work at Harvard a decade later, Osmond and Hoffer were already coming to appreciate the supreme importance of those factors in the success of their treatment. But however it worked, it worked. Or certainly seemed to. By the end of the decade, LSD was widely regarded in North America as a miracle cure for alcohol addiction. Based on this success, the Saskatchewan provincial government helped develop policies making LSD therapy a standard treatment option for alcoholics in the province. Yet not everyone in the Canadian medical establishment found the Saskatchewan results credible. They seemed too good to be true. In the early 1960s, the Addiction Research Foundation in Toronto, the leading institute of its kind in Canada, set out to replicate the Saskatchewan trials using better controls. Hoping to isolate the effects of the drug from all other variables, clinicians administered LSD to alcoholics in neutral rooms and under instructions not to engage with them during their trips, except to administer an extensive questionnaire. The volunteers were then put in constraints or blindfolded or both. Not surprisingly, the results failed to match those obtained by Osmond and Hoffer. Worse still, more than a few of the volunteers endured terrifying experiences, bad trips, as they would come to be called. Critics of treating alcoholics with LSD concluded that the treatment didn't work as well under rigorously controlled conditions, which was true enough, while supporters of the practice concluded that attention to set and setting was essential to the success of LSD therapy, which was also true. In the mid-1950s, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, learned about Osmond and Hoffer's work with alcoholics. The idea that a drug could occasion a life-changing spiritual experience was not exactly news to Bill W., as he was known in the fellowship. He credited his own sobriety to a mystical experience he had on belladonna, a plant-derived alkaloid with hallucinogenic properties that was administered to him at Towns Hospital in Manhattan in 1934. Few members of AA realize that the whole idea of a spiritual awakening leading one to surrender to a higher power, a cornerstone of Alcoholics Anonymous, can be traced to a psychedelic drug trip. 20 years later, Bill W. became curious to see if LSD, this new wonder drug, might prove useful in helping recovering alcoholics have such an awakening. Through Humphrey Osmond, he got in touch with Sidney Cohen, an internist at the Brentwood VA Hospital, and later UCLA, who had been experimenting with Sandoz LSD since 1955. Beginning in 1956, Bill W. had several LSD sessions in Los Angeles with Sidney Cohen and Betty Eisner, a young psychologist who had recently completed her doctorate at UCLA. Along with the psychiatrist Oscar Janiger, Cohen and Eisner were by then leading figures in a new hub of LSD research loosely centered on UCLA. By the mid-1950s, there were perhaps a dozen such hubs in North America and Europe. Most of them kept in close contact with one another, sharing techniques, discoveries, and sometimes drugs in a spirit that was generally more cooperative than competitive. Bill W.'s sessions with Cohen and Eisner convinced him that LSD could reliably occasion the kind of spiritual awakening he believed one needed in order to get sober. However, he did not believe the LSD experience was anything like the DTs, thus driving another nail in the coffin.